Should anyone ever have knee arthroscopy?
Pregnancy in women with lupus?
Can antibiotics manage most appendicitis?
And getting everyone to buckle up.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on June 20th, 2015. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I am so tickled by so many of these, it's just so hard for me to figure out which way to go. But I think we're going to start in the Journal of the American Medical Association with this very provocative idea, I think, in my mind at least, and one that could be hugely practice-changing. What about managing acute appendicitis with antibiotics?
So, Elizabeth, this management dates back, over 100 years ago, when there was an association made between abscesses, that is collections of inflammation or infection, and the appendix. Now, all this was done before the era of antibiotics. So people realized that people could get acute appendicitis and develop an abscess. Therefore, the proper treatment was to remove the inflamed or infected appendix. Well, now that we have antibiotics, you might ask a simple question, well, rather than removing the appendix, could we just treat it with antibiotics and how successful would that be? And that's what these investigators attempted to address. So they enrolled 530 patients between the ages of 18 to 60 that had uncomplicated acute appendicitis. They did a CT scan and made sure there wasn't any perforation or there wasn't any abscess around it. Then they took those individuals and they randomized them to have an open appendectomy or to receive antibiotics. 3 days of intravenous broad-spectrum antibiotics, followed by 7 days of oral antibiotics. And the primary endpoint for those that received surgery was it successful and uncomplicated? And for those that received antibiotics, were they able to leave the hospital without needing any surgery then or over the subsequent year? For those randomized to surgery, it was successful. 99.6% of the patients had a successful surgery, although there was a 20% complication rate. For those that received antibiotics, 73% were able to be discharge home and not require surgery over the next year. That raises the issue of whether as many as 3/4 of patients can avoid surgery by having broad spectrum antibiotics delivered.
Indeed. And so the other thing I thought was noteworthy was that even in those patients who subsequently did require surgery, there was no negative consequence of waiting.
And in fact, their complication rate was lower than those that had open appendectomy. These were individuals with uncomplicated acute appendicitis. You could actually tell the patient, okay, there are two options available. If you choose antibiotics, there's a 3/4 chance you won't need surgery, but there's a 1/4 chance you will without an increased risk of complications, or we can just take it out now.
As I suggested, I think it's going to take a really long time for this particular practice change to penetrate the community. For you right now, what would you counsel someone who presented with the symptoms of acute appendicitis, was confirmed with imaging, no perforation, no nothing relative to an emergent situation?
For each patient, it's going to be a little bit different in terms of what they want to do. Some just want to have the surgery and get it over with and not worry about it. Others say they'd like to avoid it. And I think the best thing you can do is arm the patient with the information and let them be a part of the decision-making process. Personally, I'd probably receive antibiotics. Now, what about you?
That's exactly what I would do too. As you well know, I mean, after these many years of recording, I'm not a fan of intervention. And so if there's a way to avoid a surgical intervention, I'm going to do that.
But I have to be honest, there are other people that feel just the opposite. And so armed with the information, I think neither decision is a wrong decision.
Okay. Since we're talking about interventions, then, of course, now we need to turn to the British Medical Journal. What is the impact of knee arthroscopy? And I served it up as, should anyone really ever have it?
There are about 700,000 knee arthroscopies done in the United States alone, about 150,000 in the United Kingdom. And there have been multiple trials that have really raised the question about how valuable knee arthroscopy is. It's usually performed for people that have either osteoarthritis, degeneration of the knee, or they've had tear of a ligament, for example, the medial meniscal ligament or the cartilage. Typically what happens is the patient may have pain, they have an MRI done, and they see that there are some osteoarthritic changes or some ligament damage, oftentimes referred for surgery. The interesting thing is if you took a bunch of older individuals that have no knee pain and did the same MRI, you would still find the same things. So it's not very specific. And it raised the question is, since the MRI is not very specific, these are just degenerative changes that perhaps the surgery may not be necessary. And in fact, we know that the surgery can actually promote more aggressive osteoarthritis. These authors did a systematic review and a meta-analysis looking at all the randomized control trials that met their criteria to see whether knee arthroscopy had any benefit. And then they looked at observational trials to find out what the risks were associated with it. Looking at the endpoint of did it relieve pain, their assessment was there was a very small difference in favor of knee arthroscopy early on in 3 to 6 months, but no difference after 2 years. And that difference in 3 to 6 months was pretty small. On a scale of 0 to 100, when you rate your discomfort, the difference was 2.5, no change at 2 years. But the studies did show that there were some harms associated with it. DVT, or deep vein thrombosis, a clot in the leg that happens about 4 out of every 1,000 procedures, that can result in pulmonary embolism, infection, and then rarely death. So based upon their analysis, a very inconsequential benefit seen and harms associated with knee arthroscopy.
And supports what has been intimated in the literature all the way up until this point, I think. I think you made a point with regard to the appendicitis that was really good. And that was, there are some people who want to deal with it immediately and others who are willing to kind of say, let's take a wait and see approach. Let me try the antibiotic course. I would suggest that there's something that's very similar to that operating here as well, where people who have knee pain think, okay, if I go ahead and have this arthroscopic procedure, I'm going to feel better instantly, rather than sort of taking that longer view of, oops, if I look at the numbers, my outcome is going to be the same at a year as it is in somebody who doesn't do anything.
That's why I think it's important to talk about this particular trial. Also, I think if you're the one doing the procedure, oftentimes it's hard to take a step back and admit, well, gosh, maybe this procedure isn't everything it's cracked up to be. And in fact, leaders of the arthroscopic surgery community have really poo-pooed many of these trials and said, well, they're not like my patients. My patients are somehow different. My results are different. In aggregate, it still shows the same things. Very small benefit early on and really no long-term benefit.
On that conclusion, then, let's turn to something where there is a long-term benefit. In Annals of Internal Medicine, hey, what's the impact of seatbelts on motor vehicle fatalities?
Now, we'd be hard-pressed to find anybody to say that seatbelts weren't helpful, preventing both mortality and also the morbidity, the broken bones, vertebral issues. But here's the thing that I thought was fascinating, and I wasn't aware. There are primary seatbelt laws and secondary seatbelt laws. Do you know what the difference between the two is, Elizabeth?
I have no idea.
Well, I didn't either. So what happens with primary seatbelt laws, an officer can give you a ticket if they see that you're driving and you don't have your seatbelt on. Secondary seatbelt laws mean that you can only get a ticket if you're already pulled over, you've had the accident, and you're not wearing a seatbelt. Is there a difference in the states that have primary seatbelt laws versus those that have secondary seatbelt laws with respect to motor vehicle crash fatalities? So they looked over a 10-year period from 2001 to 2010. Early on in 2001, 16 states had primary seatbelt laws. By 2010, 30 states had primary seatbelt laws. Those states that had primary seatbelt laws had lower motor vehicle crash fatality rates than states with secondary laws, 17% less fatalities. This goes beyond, does seatbelts help, to really how should we implement them? And it looks like primary seatbelt laws are very important.
Of course, something that I'm absolutely in support of. It's just one of those, wow, why wouldn't you do this? A lot like helmets with regard to motorcycle riding. The seatbelt thing, I really believe that they ought to just pull people over and say, gosh, you don't want to wear your seatbelt? Here's a $50 ticket. Have a great ride.
Well, in fact, the editorialists make several suggestions. We know they're beneficial, and this is a preventable cause of death, one of the major causes of death in people under the age of 35. So first of all, let's have primary seatbelt laws. Secondly, make it applicable to every position in the car, not just the front seat, but front and back seat. Let's increase fines, because we know that the higher the fine, the more likely people are to wear them. And let's expand high visibility enforcement at night when many of the accidents occur. And by the way, seatbelts protect you whether you're the cause of the accident or the recipient. Buckle up every time, every position.
Great public health message. Finally, let's turn to another issue also in Annals of Internal Medicine. Very common autoimmune disease, lupus. What about pregnancy outcomes?
Lupus disproportionately affects women and usually appears in childbearing ages. How do women who have lupus fare during pregnancy? The authors address that by looking at 385 patients of different ethnicities that had lupus. These women at the particular time had mild involvement. For those that became pregnant, how well did the pregnancy fare and how well do the women do? Adverse pregnancy outcomes were the exception rather than the norm. They occurred in only 19% of women. Fetal death occurred in 4%, neonatal death in 1%, preterm delivery in about 9%, and small for gestational age occurred in about 10%. One of the unfortunate things was African-American women and Hispanic women have worse outcomes 25% of the time.
So what does this suggest then about women who have lupus when they become pregnant? Close management?
Great question. There are several suggestions you can make. Pregnancy should be planned as much as possible to occur when the lupus activity is at its lowest. Every pregnancy in a woman with lupus should be considered to have the potential of being a high risk.
Excellent. I'm going to do the antibiotics for appendicitis in the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.